This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. On Friday, as we celebrate our 232nd birthday as a nation, American troops are engaged in two wars abroad. The country is considering two very different presidential candidates, and patriotism has repeatedly been raised. One of those candidates is the son and grandson of admirals, a war hero, and a former prisoner of war, to whom love of country appears to be a straightforward issue. The other is a young African-American who addressed questions about his patriotism earlier this week in a speech in Independence, Missouri. Plain and simple, patriotism presents contradictions for many African-Americans. The legacy of slavery, segregation, and racism collide with feelings of loyalty to a country that has struggled to become fairer, but which also celebrates founding fathers who owned slaves and, more than 200 years later, still faces racial and ethnic disparities. The poet Langston Hughes wrote in 1938, "Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free." That's an excerpt from Let America Be America Again by Langston Hughes. Today, black patriotism. Does our racial history prompt you to say, "Yes, I'm a patriot, but..." Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Terry Glover. She's a senior editor at ebonyjet.com, where she wrote an op-ed, "Why I Pledge," and she joins us today from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Nice to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And in that piece, you describe a scene at your daughter's 8th grade graduation ceremony where attendees were asked to stand and recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
That's right. As part of the families participating in the graduation, everyone, you know, as you are, a lot of public events, was asked to stand and recite the pledge.
And what happened?
Most of the crowd did so. A few of us didn't quite know the words and kind of mouthed it. There were a couple of people who didn't really participate at all, but for the most part, all of the parents, and it was mostly family members, the parents along with the students stood and recited the pledge. For me, it turned out to be an important moment because it was not the first time, but one of the most recent times that I have really given myself over to saying the pledge and really taking the words to heart.
And why did it was a moving moment for you?
It was. It definitely was. And it just brought home again. It's not the first time that I've thought about it, but it's something that I've been grappling with probably in the last 5 years or so, just what my position is in this country and how to reconcile, as you said earlier, how to reconcile the history of black America with the idea of pledging allegiance to this country.
And would you say, "I'm a patriot, but"?
I would say, of course I'm a patriot. And the definition of patriotism, it's important to be clear on that, because in addition to loving your country, being patriotic also means that you are willing to question and to criticize to make it a better place to live. And so I think that in that sense, black America has been more patriotic than just about any group in this country.
Also with us today is Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of The Beautiful Struggle. He's with us today from Aspen Public Radio in Aspen, Colorado. And it's nice to have you on the program again.
Thank you so much for having me back, Neil.
And I wanted to ask you, in reading your book, and we talked about it on the show a couple of weeks ago, reading your book, you grew up in a household where your father very determinedly did not celebrate the 4th of July.
He did not celebrate the 4th of July, but, excuse me, in all fairness, he didn't celebrate much else either. I've been thinking about this as I was coming on the program, and I think the thing to understand about my dad, and there are echoes of this with a lot of African Americans, my dad is a Vietnam veteran, and I think, you know, when I think about him, I have to put him in that sort of tradition of African American soldiers who have fought since the Revolutionary War, who have come back home and, you know, found themselves basically treated as second-class citizens. This goes back to the Revolutionary War coming back to slavery, the Civil War coming back to Jim Crow and debt peonage, World War I coming back to the Red Summers of 1919. I think my dad, you know, just fighting in the Vietnam War and coming back into the turbulence of the 60s to see that you put your life on the line and you still have to come back and fight for basic human rights. I think it just sort of gives you a different orientation to the world.
In a way, his service in Vietnam was what radicalized him.
That is so true. It's so true. And I think that happens with a lot of folks, because I think if you think about it, there's no, I guess, more visceral expression of patriotism than to literally put your life on the line. But I think I would echo what your earlier guest just said, and that being that by that measure, there probably is no more patriotic group than African-Americans.
Also with us today is Roger Wilkins, the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of History and American Culture at George Mason University, author of Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. And he's with us here at the museum in the Knight Studio. And Roger, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank
too.
Thank you, Neil.
And I wonder, as you listen to this, we're talking about reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in the presidential campaign. Did one candidate wear an American flag pin? Did he put his hand over his heart to recite the pledge? These are all symbols, but symbols are really important to a lot of people.
And your question?
And my question is, the symbols of this, it's interesting. You wrote about the Founding Fathers and American patriotism. You teach at George Mason University. He's one of the Founding Fathers you write about.
Symbols are important, but I think that the pressure on Senator Obama has to do with an effort by people who don't like him to use his unusual background as a signal that he's not a real American, that his patriotism is half-hearted at best, because, heck, his middle name is Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
Clay's closed, right?
Yeah.
So that's some ugliness that has arisen. My own case is very different. I was born in the bottom of the Depression, and I'm old now. I'm 76 years old. So I've lived and seen extraordinary changes on our national life. And I would say that I became a total patriot in World War II. I was 9 years old when Pearl Harbor was struck. I instantly wanted to fly fighter planes against the Germans in Europe and against the Japanese. And I devoured newspapers. Now, we lived in New York. I'd love to tell you that I devoured the New York Times or the Herald Tribune, but no, it was the Daily News. But
good pictures, though.
Pictures and maps. And so I came out of finished the war with a real deep but not terribly well-considered patriotism. Then we moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan, the western part of the state, very few blacks, and a lot of very... And we lived in a working-class neighborhood, and a lot of very traditional views of blacks. And by this time, I was figuring out what I was learning in school, and from junior high through high school, through undergraduate and law school at the University of Michigan... Until 1954, I was never assigned a book, an essay, a short story, a poem, or a play that suggested that black people had ever done anything useful in the history of the world. That kind of struck at the underpinnings of my patriotism. But then there came the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And this country did something that was really extraordinary. Black people and white people and Latino people and Native American people all looked at our history, looked at the disparities in our national life, motivated by the principles of our founding documents, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and just on the basis of those principles and the arguments of people who were handicapped in those ways, country changed in a very significant way. And I was left with extraordinary pride in this country because I don't know any other country in the history of the world that did what we did. I can go back to the Founding Fathers later on.
All right, we'll go back to the Founding Fathers. And you can give me a hard time the rest of the show, too.
I promise, not again.
Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Sill's with us from St. Louis.
Hello.
Hi.
I just want to say that I do understand the conflicts that are within many African Americans when it comes to patriotism. And when I heard about Michelle Obama's comment, I understood what she meant.
This was what she said, for the first time, I feel
yes.
proud of my country.
And I would say that many black people understood what she meant. And it didn't mean that she didn't like America or wouldn't, you know, stand up for America in situations where you needed to stand up for it. But we know the history of this country. I am 64. My father was in World War II. I have an old album where his company is segregated. There are no whites in the company except the commander. And I remember him telling me that many of the white soldiers were going around telling the women that they met in, like, France and Italy. Well, he was in Italy. That the black men had tails.
Tails.
My father was, he was not a militant, but he had certain feelings about that. And he said they were discriminated against when they were in the military.
Sill, can you stay on the line with us? We've got to go to a short break.
Yes.
All right, I'm going to put you on hold. We'll get back to you in just a minute. Thanks very much. We're going to continue our conversation about African-Americans and patriotism. Our guests again, Terry Glover of EbonyJet.com, Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of The Beautiful Struggle, and activist, history professor, and journalist Roger Wilkins. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Love of country can raise mixed feelings for some African Americans when a history of slavery and racism collides with personal feelings of pride and patriotism. Today, we've focused on black patriotism. If you have mixed feelings about it, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you can check out our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Our guests are Terry Glover, senior editor for EbonyJet.com, Ta-Nehisi Coates, the author of The Beautiful Struggle, and Roger Wilkins, former assistant attorney general in the Johnson administration, and author of Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. And today, news of a jazz singer that replaced the words of the Star-Spangled Banner with a hymn known as the Black National Anthem at a city meeting has shocked some Denver residents. And, of course, that song is called Lift Every Voice and Sing. We've learned there are some symbols important to people, Roger Wilkins, and we'll get back to that. But before we went to the break, we were talking with Sill. Sill with us from St. Louis, Missouri. And I wanted to ask you, I'm sure you were hearing Roger Wilkins talk about his experience. You're not that much younger than Roger. You must have... Yes, she is. All right. You must have had that same experience of seeing the civil rights struggle begin and progress. And now there's an African-American running for president of the United States.
Yes. I am very... happy to see where Mr. Obama has ended up right now. And I do want to say something about that lapel pin issue.
Mm-hmm.
I myself would not just wear an American flag lapel pin because I don't feel that I have the need to. But I did do something that I hadn't done in a couple of years. For the 4th of July, I put a couple of flags out in a couple of flower pots, and I just decided, well, you know, when I think about what African-American people have gone through and what my father went through in World War II and what my grandfather went through in World War I, you know, I think it's okay to put out these flags, but I'm not like just a gung-ho patriot.
Are those grandchildren we hear in the background there?
I'm sorry, yes.
Oh, please don't be sorry. I was just going to ask whether you think things will have changed significantly for them.
Well, I think about that, and my situation is this. I have a couple of biracial children, and I have an African-American child who is full African-American who goes to a school where he's in the, like there's only one in his very section, and that worries me, and I've expressed that to his parents because I feel that he won't get what he needs to be able to make it. I don't think he'll get it at school. But anyway, you do sometimes feel that internal conflict.
I understand.
Especially as a person of my age group. So I don't know. We have to work on.
I wanted to ask you, Terry Glover, obviously you've got a child who just graduated the eighth grade. Some of these same issues are going to be coming up for you.
Some of the same issues?
Yes. As you look ahead, how do you think things are going to change for your daughter as she grows up?
Oh, well, I think there are distinct differences already in her generation. And I have an older daughter who's 22. And for both of them, I think that the issue of race is not at all what it was for me, certainly not what it was for my parents. And I don't necessarily see that as a negative thing, because I think that's something that we as parents have worked towards, is for our children to feel inclusive, to be included, and to not define themselves on the basis of race. However, that doesn't mean that they should not be connected to their race and cognizant and proud of who they are as Black Americans. But, you know, I see a difference already. It's very clear that they have friends of all races, and they don't look at race as any kind of a qualifier in terms of those relationships.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, are we in approaching a post-racial atmosphere?
I don't know how post-racial... No, I would say no. And I think, you know, I was just thinking about this as Roger was talking. I think that one of the great pieces of evidence that we're not approaching a post-racial place is the very fact that Barack Obama's patriotism is being questioned at this time. And I think that has to do with the fact...
Wait, wasn't John Kerry's patriotism questioned, too, after he served in the Vietnam War?
Yes, but I don't think it's the same thing. I think, again, going back to the very specific questions regarding Michelle Obama's commentary, the fact that Barack Obama is being accused of being a Muslim, there's an outsider element to it that's sort of racialized, in my view. And I think it's sort of connected to a very long tradition of seeing African Americans as outsiders, despite the service of African Americans in the military, despite the fact that the Civil Rights Movement, which Roger talked about, was always rooted in the rhetoric of the Founding Fathers and basically asked African Americans to walk naked into fire hoses, into rabid dogs, into police waving nightsticks. And you know, you sort of put that up against people who claim that feminists caused 9/11. No one questions their patriotism. You put that against people who say that the gays caused Katrina. No one questioned these people's patriotism, but it's always African Americans who are sort of seen as the outsiders, despite the fact that African Americans historically, as I've said, you know, at the beginning, I think have demonstrated their patriotism in spite of some really harsh treatment repeatedly throughout history.
Roger, I wondered if you want to get in on this.
Well, I think it is true that blacks were for many, well, for a couple of centuries, the designated outsider. But as the country moved west, Native Americans became designated as outsiders as well. But the myth, the guilt, the anguish that went into creating a slave society, I think created a deeper kind of antipathy and need to stamp otherness on the heads of black people. I think that a lot of slave owners would have had a much harder time keeping their slaves and treating them badly had it not been for the fact that they thought that these were inferior beings, something other than. So I think that our otherness is a product of that. But let me go back to your first question about patriotism. I asked myself whether I could be patriotic about a country that was started by majority of the people were slave owners. And ultimately, I said, I'm looking at this only from a white person's point of view, as if I were white, why don't I look at this as if I had no race? Then what would I say? I would look at my slave ancestors. Because I was looking at a white perspective, because I was kind of obliterated my slave ancestors. Mm-hmm. I knew they were there, but there's no history, there's no individualism. But then I began to find out about them. And they were working people. They were forced to work. They were not paid for their labors. Some spent their entire lives in slavery. And then the thing that really got me was that I'd found out where my great-great-grandparents on my father's side were from. They were Mississippi field slaves. There couldn't be any harder kind of slavery than Mississippi field slaves. They were freed, technically, by the end of the Civil War. They were still children, but they were slammed back into semi-slavery, and that's what they did in Mississippi till they died in the second decade of the last century. But I think of their holding on, keeping their spirits together, the indications that we have that they had a sense that there would be a better day for their descendants, like me. Mm. And I have to revere those people for their fortitude and for their beliefs, and they're doing what they could to create generations that would be free.
They were right, too.
They were right. And they were Americans. They weren't treated as full Americans, but they surely weren't Chinese or Mexicans. They were Americans. And so I said to myself, these people put more down in the soil of America to create what we have now than virtually any other people on earth. Who can't love them? You got to love them. And you got to love the country they work for.
Let's get a question from here in the museum.
Hi. Barack Obama embodies many elements of American society, white as well as black, old American families and immigrants, and we know immigrants can be extremely patriotic. It seems strange, therefore, to question his patriotism because he's black, no?
You want to address that, Ta-Nehisi Coates?
Yeah, and I just wanted to highlight the fact that, you know, even as I say that we aren't moving into a post-racial society, that doesn't mean that things aren't better than they were 20, even 10 years ago. So I don't want to, you know, make it sound, you know, in that sort of fashion. But getting to the question, again, I just want to connect that to this very long tradition of when African-Americans try to establish some sort of reform in this country to people basically questioning their patriotism. I mean, this goes back to Martin Luther King and people not really believing that the civil rights movement was a homegrown thing, but some sort of communist plot inspired by the Russians. And so I'm just, you know, so when I say that about Barack Obama, I'm sort of just connecting him into that history. Also, you know, I think, you know, Roger really got at something that pretty much, you know, sums up how African-Americans feel. I mean, you understand that something horrible happened in the past and in some respects still happens today. But I think African-Americans, for the most part, desperately, desperately love this country. Chris Rock has a great, if not crude, joke where he says, America is like your uncle that molested you but paid your way through college. And you can't, you know, completely walk away from that. I think that, you know, pretty well sums up how a lot of us feel.
Let's see if we can get Elaine on the line. And, whoops, what am I doing wrong here? Apparently having trouble. I must have, I've clearly done something wrong with the phone system, and I apologize for that. Wait a minute, there you are, Elaine.
Hello.
You're on the air, go ahead, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Mr. Clever has managed to get you on the radio, I apologize.
Oh. Well, I would say if my uncle molested me, I would very easily walk away, even if he paid my way through college. So I don't know if that was the greatest example of why, as African Americans.
It's a joke, it's just a joke, it's just
a joke.
I know
it's a joke, but I understood what you were saying, and it's sort of like, that, you know, it was a good entree to sort of say that I have a very hard time. Actually, you know, just listening to the program, it makes me sort of emotional because when I think of patriotism, you know, I think that my father was a Marine. He fought in World War II. you know, he paid those kinds of dues with all of the lack of recognition that African-American soldiers got during that time. But I look and when I hear people talk about founding fathers, it sort of makes me want to retch because these men were not my father. They had nothing, you know, familial to me. They were people who raped us and who enslaved us. And so when I hear people refer to them as founding fathers, I can't relate to that. And so for most of my my adult life, actually since junior high school, I have not stood for the Pledge of Allegiance. I have not been able to, you know, put my hand over my heart and say those words because to me they were void of any meaning for me. And I have to, though, say that, you know, as we move into this unbelievable period that we're in now with Barack Obama, you know, the Democratic nominee, presumptive Democratic nominee, I have to say that, you know, from the day he won the Iowa caucus, you know, my breath was taken away because I never thought I would see this in my lifetime. And that's become sort of the cliche for so many of us now. You know, my parents are 82 years old. They certainly never thought they would see it in their lifetime. So as I watch this process, I've had to have, you know, I've had to soften myself a bit. I've had to, you know, make myself understand that, you know, that my brush might have been too broad, that my stroke is maybe going through too many people and assuming too much about people. But then on the other hand, I get an email this morning sort of previewing the CNN broadcast that's coming up in a couple of weeks on Blacks in America. And there's an anecdote in there that talks about some interview where they were able to glean that, you know, there are employers who are more willing to hire white males with felony records and no high school diploma than a black male with a college degree and no felony record. And I have a 22-year-old African-American son who is just, you know, the most wonderful child to have because he's caused me no problems. He's in law school, you know, and I watch every day as he gets sort of looked at. You know, sometimes if I'm walking with him and I'm behind him or ahead of him, I see how people look at him askance, and I worry for him. My heart bleeds for him, and I wonder, how can I pledge allegiance? How can I say I love this country?
We're talking with Elaine from Oakland, also Terry Glover of EbonyJet.com, Ta-Nehisi Coates, of the author of The Beautiful Struggle, and with Roger Wilkins. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I thought I heard you trying to get in there, Terry.
Yeah, Neil, I'd just like to say, first of all, that this whole idea of post-racial is very suspect because it seems as though it makes it sound like that America is just trying to rush through this idea of equality, and there is no level playing field. And so until that happens, there is no post-racial. I think the whole notion of that is just kind of insulting and implies that we're at a place where we are far from, and there's still a lot of work to be done. In terms of what the caller said about having this ambiguous relationship with this country, you know, we have a very rough history with this country, and a lot of people have died, and a lot of inequality has been dealt us in unfair hands. But it's like you have to have a stake in the game. It's like ownership. And if you look at a community, the renters in that community don't have much of a stake in it and don't really care about what happens there. It's the homeowners who go to the block club meetings. It's the homeowners who do the neighborhood watches. It's people who have a stake in that community and seeing it improve and prosper. And I think that we're in that same position as Americans, as black Americans. We have to have a stake in the game. And so you have to, therefore, cleave to this country and claim your stake in it, claim ownership of it before you can improve it.
Can I? Roger, go ahead.
I think that that's absolutely right, and I think the stake in the game began with the revolution.
Absolutely.
You look at the portrayals of the Revolutionary War, and you don't see any black people pictured at all. But in fact, blacks fought in every battle.
On both sides.
Yeah. On our side, they were at Lexington Concord, they were Bunker Hill, and they were fighting. They had guns. And they got wounded and they got killed. So, and then the period in between, so much of the wealth of this country was created by slave labor. I think you can see out of the back here, the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nobody knows it. Nobody makes a big deal about it, but black labor built that Capitol. So, to say after those generations of contributions by black people to the strength of this country to kind of turn away from that investment that our ancestors made, I think is not wise. I figure this is my country just as much as anybody else's feeling.
Elaine, thanks so much for the call. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about reconciling patriotism with America's history of segregation and racism. Our guests are Terry Glover, senior editor for EbonyJet.com, Ta-Nehisi Coates, the author of The Beautiful Struggle, and Roger Wilkins, former assistant attorney general in the Johnson administration, and a historian, too, author of Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers, and The Dilemma of Black Patriotism. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Darren. Darren with us from Reno in Nevada.
Hi. I just had a comment. I'm a history teacher. I teach middle school and high school, and I'm white, but I think it's one of my goals to teach patriotism in school, especially thinking about the African-American history of America, is mainly the idea of family. Every family has some things in their closet, and if you really love your family and you really love the people around you, you have to be honest with yourselves. And I think some of those blind patriots who think a simple pen is patriotism are those same people who always go out in public and say, my family's perfect, nothing's wrong, and we all know that they are just hiding something. And then I think, too, maybe like Elaine on the last one who said maybe she's painting her brush too wide, there's some people who you know say, you know, my family is horrible and I don't want anything to do with them, and maybe that's wrong, too. And, you know, if you just accept history for what it is, look at it and be honest with yourselves and say we have a long way to go, but there are great things. I mean, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Barack Obama, and I think maybe Barack Obama saw something when he went to Africa in tribalism and saw a reflection of tribalism here in America, and that's one of his things where I see politically and I've kind of really come to appreciate is this idea of you have to get rid of tribalism if you're going to move ahead as a society. And that's just kind of my take on it. Of course, you know, I'm a white guy from the Intermountain West, and that's just my take. And I appreciate all of your guys' comments.
Oh, well,
thank you.
Darren, thanks for the call. Roger Wilkins, you're the historian here.
I would just say that the white guy for the Intermountain West had a great list of black Americans, but he left out Halle Berry.
I'm sure Darren is going to correct his mistake right now.
And I also ought to say that today, this very day, is Justice Thurgood Marshall's 100th birthday, and he was a mentor of mine and a friend of mine, and I'm glad to be able to say that here.
Thanks very much for the call, Darren. And here's an email from Heather in Berkeley, California, who notes that I think you've incorrectly cited Michelle Obama's statement at least twice now. She said, for the first time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country. The qualifications of adult and really proud changed the meaning of the sentence and are important to note. And we thank you for the correction. And here's an email that we have from Mike. While I do not doubt the patriotism of most African Americans, why do African Americans make such efforts to not integrate into American culture? As American patriots, why do African Americans have black colleges, black churches, black fraternities, black magazines, etc.? As an individual of Germanic heritage, while I'm proud of my heritage, I am an American. And again, Roger, this is an historical question in terms of when these institutions were founded and what purpose they had.
The black colleges were founded because black people were not permitted to go to most of the colleges in the United States. So, and they were created in the period after the Civil War at a time when in the South the terrorists, the deemers, to trying to recreate the pre-bellum South made it very difficult for blacks to do anything except go back into slavery. As to why blacks don't integrate it, it's in large measure because there is still enough racism and discomfort in the society that a lot of black people do not feel comfortable participating in social activities with whites, and often we're not invited.
Yeah. But
I got a letter from a brilliant young friend of mine, black, who said, he calls me a Luddite because I don't like the internet. But anyway, he's saying, "Dear Luddite, here I'm going to tell you that I have been sampling life on the friendship circuits of the internet." And he said, "What I find really is stunning, because I find that so few of the white people I know have, or few of these people that come up on the internet have any black friends at all." He said, "So it's still a very socio-cultural issue in which blacks really don't feel like, lots of blacks really don't feel like kind of pushing their way into a white social society that looks unready to greet them."
I was going to ask you to come in on this, Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yeah, I would question the presumption that black people haven't tried to integrate. First of all, the term white flight was invented for a reason. It's not like African Americans don't try to move into white neighborhoods. They've, you know, historically been barred by law, and when not barred by law, people weren't especially welcome to them moving in. Also, I mean, if you just look at the measures of citizenship, again, you know, as we've all talked about, military service, voting, et cetera, I think African Americans have made phenomenal efforts to try to integrate. The integrationist tradition in African-American activism is probably much more stronger than a nationalist tradition. It's no mistake that Martin Luther King is the saint in terms of African-Americans. The civil rights movement is held up, which was wholly premised on integration. I also would question the idea that seems to underline this, and that is that somehow white culture is American culture, that African-American culture hasn't been a persistent source for American culture. I don't know that you can have American culture without, say, jazz, for instance. And at this, you know, point, dare I say hip-hop? I would go so far as to say I don't know if you could have a Barack Obama without hip-hop at this point. I know that's a little far out there, but I mean, if you look at hip-hop and look at how, you know, it's brought blacks and whites together in ways that, you know, just weren't true before, I think I would really question this idea that black culture sits over here and has not really contributed to American culture. I don't know how you have American culture without black people. Mm-hmm.
And Terry Glover, there certainly is both black and white separatism.
There is, and I would have to agree with Ta-Nehisi. I think that we have gone to extreme measures to be inclusive, to be included in the mainstream, and have been rebuffed both legally, culturally, socially. Any way that you could parse that, we've been rejected. But our culture has very much been a part of the larger American culture, and we would not have an American culture without the contributions of black Americans.
There's no Elvis without black people.
Exactly.
I would also say that there is no more. I have a daughter who's in the Obama campaign, and I must say I have never seen as integrated an operation in my life in terms of color, in terms of age. It is a new phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. It's a discussion that could go on, and in fact, we had planned for it to go on for the remainder of the hour, but there's some important news that we need to get to. But let me thank our guests. You just heard Roger Wilkins, a former Assistant Attorney General, and Clarence J. Robinson, Professor of History and American Culture at George Mason University. We'll get to the Founding Fathers another time, Roger. And author of Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. He was with us here in the museum. Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of The Beautiful Struggle, with us from Aspen Public Radio in Aspen, Colorado. And Terry Glover, senior editor for EbonyJet.com, who wrote an op-ed in Ebony Jet called Why I Pledge. And she joined us today from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you all so much for your time
today.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
And when thank you, Neil.
And thank you, Ta-Nehisi. When we come back, we'll have news for you about the release, the rescue of Ingrid Betancourt and other hostages held by the FARC guerrillas in Colombia. Stay with us. And we have news this hour from Colombia that Ingrid Betancourt, the former presidential candidate in Colombia, and three American hostages have been freed. Colombia's defense minister, Juan Manuel Santos, says the military rescued 15 hostages in all. It's been more than 6 years since Betancourt was taken hostage by Marxist guerrillas known as the FARC. NPR's Juan Ferrero has been following this story. He happens to be in Washington, D.C. today and joins us now by phone from his hotel here in Washington. And Juan, good to have you on the program.
Good to be here.
And what do we know about today's rescue?
There's not much information at the moment. The defense ministry said today, this afternoon, just a few minutes ago, that it had rescued Ingrid Betancourt, who's a very well-known French-Colombian politician and author, as well as three Americans who had been held since 2003 by the FARC. There's also a rescue of about 11 Colombian soldiers who had also been held by that rebel group in very isolated jungle territory.
And these people, Ingrid Betancourt, there had been some progress of late. A few hostages had been let go after some, contentious negotiations that involved the president of Venezuela as well.
That's correct. Early this year, the FARC had released some hostages into the hands of President Hugo Chavez, who had been negotiating with that rebel group. But then, in recent months, the Colombian government has struck some very hard blows against the FARC. They'd killed some top commanders, and the FARC said it was no longer going to be making any more unilateral releases. The world has really sort of been shocked by the way the hostages have been treated. There are as many as 700 hostages in the Colombian jungles. Many of them are soldiers and policemen who've been captured in combat. Some of them have been held for as long as 10 years. And then there were some very well-known pawns. The best known was, of course, Ingrid Betancourt. France's government had been heavily involved in trying to get her released. And then there were three American hostages. And John McCain, who's in Colombia, or was in Colombia until just recently, he was there yesterday and this morning, he even talked about this issue of the three Americans.
All we have of this news thus far is from the Colombian Defense Ministry. Has anybody seen the hostages?
I don't know at this point. It appears that they came out with this release that they had rescued these people. And that in and of itself has been very contentious because the families had long said, we never want there to be a rescue, because the FARC's policy has been, if there's a rescue, you kill the hostages.
We're talking with NPR's Juan Ferrero about news today of the release of Ingrid Betancourt, three Americans, and other hostages in Colombia. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So if this news can be believed, Juan, it has to be accepted as a blow to an organization, the FARC, which, as you mentioned, two of its most important leaders have been killed, one in a cross-border raid into Ecuador and the other by an apparently disgruntled bodyguard. There have been other defections from the organization of late. It used to control large swaths of the country and has been pushed back significantly.
Yes, I've been in Colombia for many years now, and in the past, the FARC controlled at least a third of the territory, meaning that they held sway. They may not have been able to hold every town against an army offensive, but they were infiltrated in towns, in many communities throughout Colombia, rural Colombia. In recent months, the FARC has just suffered one blow after another. There have been mass desertions of hundreds of guerrillas every month, and a lot of these guerrillas are taking with them a lot of information that the Colombian military is then using to capture or to strike at the FARC. And apparently the military did say that they did have information about the hostages. So clearly there was some kind of intelligence gathering here that was crucial. There have been cases where the military has come very close to the hostages and then pulled back. Not too long ago, the military revealed that a special elite platoon of commandos had come so close to the Americans that they had seen the three of them bathing in a river. But the platoon and the soldiers in that platoon knew that the FARC was very nearby, and so they didn't come any closer. They knew that the FARC could kill these guys, and then what? What would they have?
The FARC has also, had sometimes the support of neighboring government in Venezuela and sometimes not. Just after the release of the first hostages in the negotiations earlier this year, Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, called upon the world to recognize the FARC as a legitimate revolutionary movement. And then just a few weeks later, he called on them to drop their arms.
Yes, exactly. Well, what happened in between that time is that the Colombian government revealed, released the information bit by bit from a computer that was captured in a rebel camp, and that computer showed that there had been quite close links between President Hugo Chavez and the FARC. This was continuing to come out, and this was an embarrassment for Venezuela's government. Venezuela has denied that it has ties to the FARC or that in any way helps the FARC, but Hugo Chavez, at least rhetorically, has been supportive of the FARC. He said that their struggle is a struggle that we support and that we respect here in Venezuela. That did not go over well in Colombia, and it really didn't catch on in any other part of the world either. Very recently, Chavez took another tack, and he said that the armed struggle in Colombia had no future, that the FARC should release its hostages, make a big gesture and release those hostages, and that the FARC should enter into peace negotiations with the Colombian government.
And very quickly, Juan, tell us who these three American hostages are.
Well, these three American hostages are men who were contractors with the Pentagon. They had worked for a private company, and they were captured when their plane went down in the southern part of Colombia back in 2003. Their names are Thomas Howes, Mark Gonsalves, and Keith Stanzel, and their families have been pushing for their release for years, so this must be a big day for them.
Thanks very much, Juan Ferrero, and obviously more on this story later today on All Things Considered, and stay tuned to NPR News for the latest. Thank you very much, Juan.
Thank you.
And at the next week, when we broadcast from the museum, we'll have a rather well-known substitute host as I'm on vacation. Ted Koppel will join us to do that broadcast. If you'd like tickets, you can send an email to tickets@npr.org. That's next week here at the museum on Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington. And we have news this hour from Colombia that Ingrid Betancourt, the former presidential candidate in Colombia, and three American hostages have been freed. Colombia's defense minister, Juan Manuel Santos, says the military rescued 15 hostages in all. It's been more than 6 years since Betancourt was taken hostage by Marxist guerrillas known as the FARC. NPR's Juan Ferrero has been following this story. He happens to be in Washington, D.C. today and joins us now by phone from his hotel here in Washington. And Juan, good to have you on the program.
Good to be here.
And what do we know about today's rescue?
There's not much information at the moment. The defense ministry said today, this afternoon, just a few minutes ago, that it had rescued Ingrid Betancourt, who's a very well-known French-Colombian politician and author, as well as three Americans who had been held since 2003 by the FARC. There's also a rescue of about 11 Colombian soldiers who had also been held by that rebel group in very isolated jungle territory.
And these people, Ingrid Betton, there had been some progress of late. A few hostages had been let go after some, contentious negotiations that involved the president of Venezuela as well.
That's correct. Early this year, the FARC had released some hostages into the hands of President Hugo Chavez, who had been negotiating with that rebel group. But then, in recent months, the Colombian government has struck some very hard blows against the FARC. They'd killed some top commanders, and the FARC said it was no longer going to be making any more unilateral releases. The world has really sort of been shocked by the way the hostages have been treated. There are as many as 700 hostages in the Colombian jungles. Many of them are soldiers and policemen who've been captured in combat. Some of them have been held for as long as 10 years. And then there were some very well-known pawns. The best known was, of course, Ingrid Betancourt. France's government had been heavily involved in trying to get her released. And then there were three American hostages. And John McCain, who's in Colombia, or was in Colombia until just recently, he was there yesterday and this morning, he even talked about this issue of the three Americans.
All we have of this news thus far is from the Colombian Defense Ministry. Has anybody seen the hostages?
I don't know at this point. It appears that no, that they came out with this release that they had rescued these people. And that in and of itself has been very contentious because the families had long said, we never want there to be a rescue, because the FARC's policy has been, if there's a rescue, you kill the hostages.
We're talking with NPR's Juan Ferrero about news today of the release of Ingrid Betancourt, three Americans, and other hostages in Colombia. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So if this news can be believed, Juan, it has to be accepted as a blow to an organization, the FARC, which, as you mentioned, two of its most important leaders have been killed, one in a cross-border raid into Ecuador and the other by an apparently disgruntled bodyguard. There have been other defections from the organization of late. It used to control large swaths of the country and has been pushed back significantly.
Yes, I've been in Colombia for many years now, and in the past, the FARC controlled at least a third of the territory, meaning that they held sway. They may not have been able to hold every town against an army offensive, but they were infiltrated in towns, in many communities throughout Colombia, rural Colombia. In recent months, the FARC has just suffered one blow after another. There have been mass desertions of hundreds of guerrillas every month, and a lot of these guerrillas are taking with them a lot of information that the Colombian military is then using to capture or to strike at the FARC. And apparently the military did say that they did have information about the hostages. So clearly there was some kind of intelligence gathering here that was crucial. There have been cases where the military has come very close to the hostages and then pulled back. Not too long ago, the military revealed that a special elite platoon of commandos had come so close to the Americans that they had seen the three of them bathing in a river. But the platoon and the soldiers in that platoon knew that the FARC was very nearby, and so they didn't come any closer. They knew that the FARC could kill these guys, and then what? What would they have?
The FARC has also, had sometimes the support of neighboring government in Venezuela and sometimes not. Just after the release of the first hostages in the negotiations earlier this year, Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, called upon the world to recognize the FARC as a legitimate revolutionary movement. And then just a few weeks later, he called on them to drop their arms.
Yes, exactly. Well, what happened in between that time is that the Colombian government released the information bit by bit from a computer that was captured in a rebel camp, and that computer showed that there had been quite close links between President Hugo Chavez and the FARC. This was continuing to come out, and this was an embarrassment for Venezuela's government. Venezuela has denied that it has ties to the FARC or that in any way helps the FARC, but Hugo Chavez, at least rhetorically, has been supportive of the FARC. He said that their struggle is a struggle that we support and that we respect here in Venezuela. That did not go over well in Colombia, and it really didn't catch on in any other part of the world either. Very recently, Chavez took another tack, and he said that the armed struggle in Colombia had no future, that the FARC should release its hostages, make a big gesture and release those hostages, and that the FARC should enter into peace negotiations with the Colombian government.
And very quickly, Juan, tell us who these three American hostages are.
Well, these three American hostages are men who were contractors with the Pentagon. They had worked for a private company, and they were captured when their plane went down in the southern part of Colombia back in 2003. Their names are Thomas Howes, Mark Gonsalves, and Keith Stanzel, and their families have been pushing for their release for years, so this must be a big day for them.
Thanks very much, Juan Ferrero, and obviously more on this story later today on All Things Considered, and stay tuned to NPR News for the latest. Thank you very much, Juan.
Thank you.
And at the next week, when we broadcast from the museum, we'll have a rather well-known substitute host as I'm on vacation. Ted Koppel will join us to do that broadcast. If you'd like tickets, you can send an email to tickets@npr.org. That's next week here at the museum on Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington.